from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. 40% of the food in the U.S. goes uneaten each year, amounting to $165 billion annually. It's a hard fact to swallow in a country where one in six Americans lacks a secure food supply. Food is wasted all over the place, starting on the farm, but consumers are the worst culprits in many ways. We leave food on our restaurant plates, allow it to spoil in our refrigerators, or throw it out because we mistakenly believe it's gone bad. Let's talk about it. How can we reduce the waste and consume more of the food we buy? That's after this on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Michael Krasny. We are wasting food. Globally, nearly half the food on a planet with a billion hungry people went uneaten. In the U.S., where, unlike some developing countries, we have wide access to refrigeration and proper food storage, 40% of food is tossed out every year. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, a quarter of what is presently in your refrigerators will be thrown out. In this Forum Hour, we talk about food waste. Why are we producing so much of it, and what can be done about it? Joining us now, we have Dana Gunders, in-studio staff scientist for the Natural Resources Defense Council, Sue Sigler, executive director of the California Association of Food Banks, and Tara Duggan, author of Root to Stock Cooking, The Art of Using the Whole Vegetable. Thank you all for joining us this morning. And a staff writer, I should mention, for the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me start today with Dana Gunders of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Can you sort of give us the lay of the land?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, here in the U.S., we are not eating 40% of our food supply, and that's getting lost all the way along the supply chain.
Starting at the farm,
where products that don't look quite right, never make it off the farm, all the way through to our stores where they need to carry so many products and have such an abundance of food available for anyone to walk in at any time to grab. And that leads to quite a bit of waste, all the way through to our homes where the lettuce goes bad in the fridge and we throw away things because they may be past their dates.
Nobody seems to want to waste food. I think if anyone was stopped on the street, they would say that's not a goal of mine in life. How did we get to this place?
You know, it's interesting. When we're in the store, we are so careful about penny pinching. You know, just 5 cents of a change in price will tip us over. And then when we get home, we seem to kind of just absorb that food and not really think so much about it. Also, you know, generally speaking, for much of the population, food is not a huge portion of their budget. And so it's just easier. It's a convenience thing to throw it out and when you don't get around to cooking it. And same is true for businesses. You know, the cost of labor is much higher than the cost of food for most food businesses. And that actually leads to maximizing the labor, which can sometimes lead to food being thrown out.
Sarah Sigler, I remember visiting a food bank in Sonoma County many years ago and just being stunned by how much food they were managing to get from local farms that supermarkets wouldn't look at. Grapefruits that were either far too big for what we consider a typical grapefruit or far too small. Sue, can you explain what that is, how that's working through our system these days?
Sure. Well, at food banks throughout California, we're very dependent on the generosity of farmers for those excess farm products. And what can happen on the farm are any number of things. One, as you mentioned, is that there are a lot of products that don't look quite right. They might be over or undersized. They might be slightly blemished. They don't line up perfectly in the grocery store in the way that we're used to seeing the display. And so we work with growers and packers from around the state to capture those products they might be called cull products or seconds or B grade, depending on the individual crop. And for us, we run a program called Farm to Family, where we work with those growers and packers to access those cull products, and then we provide them to food banks around the state, who in turn provide them to low-income people who may not have a budget or access to fresh produce. And each year, we do well over 120 million pounds of cull products through our system, and that really speaks to the generosity of farmers in California.
Farmers naturally want to get the crop off the farm and into markets where it can be sold, where money can be made. Dana Gunders, can you clear this up for us? I guess for the most of the waste is actually happening in the home.
Well, you know, to be honest, for starters, we actually don't have great data on sort of a holistic level to look at the whole food system and say exactly where it's happening. A lot of it is happening in our homes and in restaurants, but a significant amount, particularly with fruits and vegetables, is happening on farms as well, for the reasons that Sue described. And you know, there are huge resources being poured into this food. In the U.S., over 80% of our water consumption and half our land area go towards growing food and agriculture. And when we're not eating almost half of that, 40%, it's a huge waste of resources.
Do you have a sense of whether that benefits anybody, or it's just a function of unconsciousness in our system?
I don't think it's unconsciousness. I think they're actually, people are very aware in their own businesses of where things are being wasted. In our homes, it is flying a little bit under the radar. But it's hard. It's hard to do. What Farm to Family has done has been very pioneering. You know, they've come up with models where the workers are actually picking the produce that would otherwise get skipped over and putting it in a separate box, and they're covering costs. And there's a lot of logistics involved with moving food around, particularly with our kind of industrial food system, where food has to move very far in refrigerated trucks, and that gets expensive. And so it's no accident. It's sort of the way it's been designed a little bit.
And I take it, Sue Sigler, that that's volunteer labor for the most part, donations paying for the gas that goes in those refrigerated trucks?
Well, actually, the way that we work with farmers is that about 20% of what we receive is an outright donation. So very generous farmers who might have excess, those excesses tend to come in the system perhaps at the end of a growing season, when there's excess in the cooler. The farmer could cut costs by emptying out that cooler and saving on the energy costs. Or at times when there might be a glut or a severe drop in market prices. And at that point, it becomes disadvantageous for the farmer to harvest perhaps an entire field. So if we think about the farmer already has the investment in putting that crop in, but if they have to sell it at a loss, it doesn't make sense, obviously, to pay for the labor and packaging to get it out of the field. And so for about 80% of our program, we work with farmers by providing what's called in the industry a PPO fee, for picking and pack out fee, that covers only labor and materials to get the food out of the field and to the food bank. And that's usually expressed as a couple of cents per pound. And food banks are able to provide that through the generosity of folks that donate and support their local food bank.
You know, a lot of people in the Bay Area and California generally support their local food bank. A lot of people in the Bay Area and California generally have a compost bin. And I'm one of those people, but I would call it the compost bin of shame. It is amazing how often it fills and has to be emptied during the course of 1 week. And I'm aware of it. I feel bad about it. What can I do about it, Dana Gunders?
Well, first, I want to say I think we're very lucky here in the Bay Area to have composting because it's, you know, 97% of the food scraps in this country actually go to landfills. So it certainly is a huge step of improvement. But I'm with you. I have a compost of shame regularly, too. And I think there is so much we can be doing in our homes and in our lives to make a dent in our own food waste, starting with our freezers. I don't think people use, you know, they're very underutilized, our freezers. You can freeze almost anything, bread, cheese, milk, it'll all defrost and be okay. And that helps with our busy lives, which is another reason. You know, I think we go to the store and are not realistic about planning.
Tara Duggan, you've spent a lot of time thinking about this very question with your new book, Root to Stock Cooking, which makes the argument we're just not using as much of the vegetable bounty that we have that we could be using in our refrigerator.
Exactly. And like Dana said, it's a lot about being realistic. So, for example, you may plan – it's great to plan out meals for the week, but maybe – don't plan five meals for 5 weeknights because you may just have a night where you're going to need to get takeout because you went to the gym and you're tired or you picked your kid up from soccer at 6:30 and you don't have time to cook. So it's good to plan in some flexibility. And one of the ways to do that is to combine frozen and fresh food. And actually a lot of frozen produce has a high nutrient level because it was frozen at when it was at its peak ripeness, for example. So a lot of it is being realistic with the ingredients that you have and how to use them.
Is that the kind of thinking you need to employ before you head to the market?
Yeah. I mean, none of us is perfect. It can be hard to plan really specifically. But, for example, if one thing you can do maybe on a Sunday, do your shopping, make a big some kind of protein that will last you for two meals. You can have your Sunday dinner. For example, I did a pork shoulder this Sunday on the grill. It was really nice. I cooked it and I saved half for Tuesday night because I knew I may not want it right away on Monday night. And it was delicious. And I planned another vegetable for the second night so that it would be a little bit of variety. So that's an example of what you can do.
We asked our listeners on Facebook to share what they're doing to reduce food waste, and we've got some very interesting responses. Paul says, plan to eat less, great for losing weight. Gail writes, soup, shake, or juice, then compost. And then this comment from Melissa, the first way to avoid wasting food is not to have kids. in Melissa's defense, she has kids, and she says hers can be crazy picky, and it drives her nuts how much food they waste. Tara Duggan, you have dealt with this. You have two daughters of your own.
That's true. And it can be very frustrating to see the food go to waste, but you also want to provide them with lots of options, especially when it comes to fruit and vegetables. So I try to have at least a few different options and try not to feel too bad when they don't eat all of it.
You don't end up trying to eat it yourself out of sense of
sometimes,
guilt.
Sometimes, but there's only so much extra broccoli I can eat. So.
Dana Gunders, sometimes we sabotage ourselves by tossing stuff out before it's really expired.
It's true. Many people in this country believe that the dates on food actually mean the product is unsafe to eat. But in fact, those dates are all about freshness and not about the safety of the food at all. And that's your best buy and your use by dates. They're really meant to tell us that as a suggestion for when the product is at its peak quality. And yet 9 out of 10 Americans, according to one study, actually are throwing food out because they're afraid of the safety of that food on the dates.
I have to admit, in the market, if I see that expiration date is coming up, I'm digging in the back, of the dairy case to get the one that I know has been marked with a later expiration date. Given how much you've studied this question, do you have a sense of what we might do to tinker with that system? Do we need two dates, each one clearly labeled? Should we switch to a different date, which would be the date by which you should not be eating this piece of food?
Well, the first thing to know is right now there are two buckets of dates. So one are the sell-by dates that you see on some products, and those are really meant to tell the store when to sell the food. And they build in some life for the consumer to have it once they get it home. So those dates absolutely do not mean anything about the product being not of quality. And to your question, what should we do? Well, I believe those sell-by dates are not really serving people because they are confusing people who do believe, oh my gosh, I can't eat this food after that date. And so if we could kind of make those invisible and rather have a date, even if it is a freshness date that remains on the product, but very clearly states this is a freshness date, not something ambiguous like use by that is already confusing people.
Sue Sigler, any thoughts? I see you nodding your head over there.
Well, that conversation about dates is very familiar to us in the food banking world because obviously we get a lot of donations of products from retailers that are at or near their expiration date. And so there's two issues for us there. One is we want food bank consumers to understand that this is perfectly good food. We haven't given anyone anything tainted. Additionally, for them not to feel like we gave them something as second-class citizens, that food still is perfectly good. And it's, as Dana said, it's a very common misconception that the food is no longer good once it reaches that date. And Dana, maybe you can say, it's my understanding that there's a variety of times past that sell-by or use-by date that for different products that it remains good with shelf life. So it might be a couple of days for something like meat, and it might be a couple of weeks for some other products.
Right. Well, the first thing to know is that while the dates appear to be a very rational, objective system, it's more like the Wild Wild West. There are no federal regulations requiring those dates. The dates are different in all 50 states in terms of the laws that oversee them. And the manufacturers, it's typically up to them kind of whether to use a date, which date they choose to use in terms of the words, and how they come up with those dates. So even for the same product, you could have one manufacturer doing lab testing and consumer taste testing, and another one literally just kind of having an educated guess or doing something according to what their competitors are doing. So for any product, it's actually hard to say. Mm-hmm. The FDA does say they do have a chart that recommends dates past, you know, kind of times past the date that you could eat things. And for eggs, for instance, they say 3 to 5 weeks after that date, eggs are good to eat.
How is it that the food banks know, given that things are so confusing, what they can give to hungry people versus what they really shouldn't?
Well, there's obviously – the first thing is what we all do, right? The sniff test. Right? So obviously if something looks off, smells bad, is in a damaged package, might have been subject to contamination of some kind, that is not something a food bank would accept, or if it comes in a food drive barrel or something, it would be something that would be discarded. And other than that, we're continually talking to folks who are receiving product and have questions and helping to educate folks about when food remains good to eat and holding ourselves to a very high standard of never distributing anything that would cause anyone harm.
Dana Gunders, how do you tell where the give line is? Even as a consumer, you just mentioned that eggs can last up to a month after the expiration date. What are some other examples? What kind of foods do I need to be worried about if they're past their expiration date?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing to know is that most foodborne illness comes from contamination and not kind of age of product. And so when you hear about E. coli or Salmonella, that's a contaminated product, and that contamination happened on the farm or in the processing plant or something. So when you cook foods, that would kill it. And more important to the safety of foods is keeping it at the right temperature, because those things can't grow in the refrigerator, than the date itself. Now, the big exception to that is a pathogen called Listeria that can grow in the refrigerator. And so for products that you eat raw that can be contaminated with Listeria, we need to be careful. And one of those is ready-to-eat sandwiches. That's actually when you look at the kind of world of food safety and what is always held up as the most dangerous food, because those deli meats and anything that they tell pregnant women not to eat are things that can actually carry Listeria.
You know, you've talked about the fact that we fundamentally understand when food is unsafe and that we're sort of conflating it with when food is at its peak.
It's true. I think the sniff test is actually more important than we give it credit for. We worked with a food safety expert out of the University of Minnesota named Ted Labuza on the dating game report that we recently published about these date labels. And he says in his entire career, he has never heard of a foodborne illness that has come just because of out-of-code dating.
Tara Duggan, you know, can you talk about, I guess, the flip side of that concern, which is, you know, let's say that there's something that is past its prime. What are some tips and tricks for making the most out of food that may have lost a little of its charm?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you don't want to eat anything that's unappetizing to you, or it doesn't want to, you don't want to feel like it's drudgery to eat your leftovers, but there are things you can do. You can spruce up vegetables that are a little bit limp in some cold water, and some vegetables that may be a little less fresh looking. They're better to use cooked than in a raw, you know, in a salad. So if you've got, it's better to just go ahead and spruce it up by cooking it. Also, when you chop something up in a salad, you're more likely to see flaws in the food. But again, I always think you should enjoy your food and feel good about it. One thing I recommend, for example, if you have one thing people often have is leftover fresh herbs, you can chop those up maybe in a food processor or a blender, add some olive oil and vinegar or salt, garlic. You've got sort of like a pesto that can be used for all kinds of things, to put on meats, to put in salads. So that's one way to preserve the life of a common thing that we all buy that we often waste.
How about bread?
Bread is great. I mean, a lot of cultures use old bread as part of their cuisine. And so, for example, I love using old pita bread in a salad. You toast it up kind of like a crouton, add it to a salad with some fresh herbs. It's called a fetouche salad. Old tortillas are used in chilaquiles, which is a delicious Mexican breakfast. And you can use old bread for croutons, for toasts, for appetizers, things like that.
I often find that if the bread is just about a day stale, if I put it in the oven with an oven-safe container that has water in it, and then so there's humidity in the oven, it kind of revives the bread just enough to eat immediately.
Exactly, yeah.
We've been getting a lot of great tips and tricks from people writing in. Deborah emails, we really can do a lot at home. I feed my food scraps to my chickens, which supply me and my neighbors with eggs. I compost the rest and then put that compost in the garden and grow vegetables. And please, let's all support local farmers through CSA and Farmers Market. But there again, you know, it is possible to overbuy at the Farmers Market or to get a box every week that is just delivering more rutabagas than most people know what to do with. Have you encountered that at all, Tara Duggan?
Yes. That's why I wrote this book about working with vegetables from the root to stock, as I call it. And you get a big box of produce from a farm called a CSA membership, and you suddenly have all these greens and turnips, especially in the winter time. And it's a challenge. And one thing you can do is you can prep some of the vegetables ahead of time, and so that they're kind of ready to go. Vegetables that take a little bit longer to prep, for example, lettuce that has to be washed, maybe spend a little extra time a few days in advance, get those vegetables ready for when you're more busy. And also, one thing people don't always think about is pickling. You can do a lot of quick pickles with carrots, or if you have a lot of extra cauliflower carrots, keep those in the refrigerator. It doesn't have to be a pickle that you spend 2 days putting into jars, for example, but you can just find an easy recipe and keep it in your refrigerator. So there are ways to extend the life of extra vegetables.
And I suppose you could always invite friends over to help
right. You
eat what you can't eat yourself or what your family refuses to eat. We are talking about food waste. What advice can you offer from your experience in the kitchen? Or are you working on an app for that in tech-savvy Bay Area audiences? One presumes that we have people who are coming up with very clever ways to solve some of these problems. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Post on our Facebook page or head to our website, kqed.org/forum. Whatever your mode of communication, we are ready for your comments and questions. And we'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about food waste, the good, the bad, and the ugly. No, come to think of it, there probably isn't a good side to food waste, but we've got wonderful people to talk about it with. That would be Dana Gunders, staff scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Sue Sigler, executive director for the California Association of Food Banks, Tara Duggan, staff writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, and author of Root to Stock Cooking, The Art of Using the Whole Vegetable, and Dana Fraz, founder and executive director of Food Shift, an organization that works to develop long-term sustainable solutions to reduced waste. Dana Fraz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me and for hosting this important conversation.
So as you've been listening this hour to what we've been talking about, you have been in this business of trying to get food waste reduced for years now. What would you like to see change? If you could wave a magic wand, somebody made you queen for a day, what would you change right away?
Yeah, thanks. So I see a real flaw and limitation in the current food recovery space. There are so many organizations who are working hard to recover and redistribute food. And the reality is they can't do it as at the level that it needs to happen nationally. We have so much food going in the trash. 35 years ago, we had 200 emergency food programs. Now we have more than 40,000. And yet the problems of hunger and food waste persist and are, in fact, more heightened than ever before. Most food recovery groups provide their services for free and depend on volunteer labor and donations to operate. And this is really financially challenging, and it limits their ability to expand, purchase necessary infrastructure, and recover more food that's being currently trashed in our communities. Additionally, we think food alone won't solve the problem of hunger, and we really need to shift our thinking about how we address these problems. And at Food Shift, we'd really like to see the creation of jobs in the recovery and redistribution of food. And this is a perfect opportunity to provide employment for people in our community who need the jobs the most and invite them to be part of solving this critical social and environmental problem.
Dana Gunders, does that sound right to you, professionalizing perhaps? I mean, there are a lot of professionals working in the nonprofit world to try to get food to people who need it, but perhaps we should make it a more attractive line of work with bigger salaries?
I would love to see that. I think we all would. My ideal world, we would be feeding everyone intentionally, and it wouldn't be sort of left up to charities to pop up where they felt the need, but rather we would design it into our national system somehow. For instance, Howard Buffett Foundation has a program called Invest an Acre, where they have farmers who, quote, set aside an acre effectively and donate that to people in need and hungry. And I think programs that are designing that into the system are fantastic.
Sue Sigler?
I think it's important to comment also on the extent of the need that's out there. We know in California and nationally that one out of every six people doesn't regularly get enough to eat, and that it looks worse if you're a young person, where one in four children regularly don't get enough to eat. And I think it also speaks to the complexity of the food system. It'd be really easy to ask oneself the question of, well, if there's excess over here and there's need over there, why don't we just trot it across town? And it doesn't really work like that when we think about folks who live in food deserts and don't have access to either a full-service retailer or any store that provides fresh produce and other types of varieties of food that one needs for health, and a variety of other factors. People may be very limited by their budget, like I said, may not have access. And so there really aren't simple solutions in that equation. We have to think a lot more critically about it.
It also seems that a lot of people struggle from lack of education. It's not just me here sitting wondering what I can do with my rotting vegetables. A lot of people aren't entirely clear how to get the most out of the food they have, or how to sort of steer themselves to the parts of the markets where they can get the most nutritious foods. But it seems like food banks are trying to address that now.
Food banks have been engaging in the health and nutrition conversation for quite some time now. And for the last 10 years, we operated a statewide program working with 28 different sites around the state to provide nutrition education information to food bank consumers and clients. But one of the things that's always struck me out of that conversation is that it's not about low-income people. There's some evidence to point to low-income people actually making slightly better food choices for their health and nutrition than the average American, and that would lead us to a whole conversation about packaged processed food versus fresh food, how much cooking are people doing in their kitchens, and I don't suspect that Dana would have numbers on this, but I think it would be interesting to look at the ratio of packaged and processed food that's wasted. I'm going to guess that that is consumed much more fully than the fresh fruits and vegetables that we bring into our kitchen.
Dana Gunders, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. And I think part of that is a function of the perishability of food and, mm-hmm. and just how quickly fresh products do go bad. But I think, you know, to Sue's point, you know, people on a very low budget cook if they, you know, if they have the time, and that's a time is a big factor in this equation as well. But, you know, the cheapest way to feed yourself is to cook. It's also much healthier. And so and people who cook who become familiar with food probably throw out less because they figure out, as Tara's been pointing out, you know, how to cook it, how to use it to its fullest. So I do think, you know, becoming more familiar with our kitchens and doing more cooking is really a win-win for everyone.
Does that sound right to you, Dana Fraz?
Absolutely.
And I guess, too, we're not going to get much argument on that from Tara Duggan. You know, here's a question, Tara Duggan. I've talked with people who are, you know, struggling, low income. Oftentimes a big issue is transportation. If you can't get your buddy to drive you to the market, you can't load up beyond what you can physically carry back on the bus. And that means you have to start making decisions based on, I guess, your upper body strength. What are ways that somebody who's dealing with a limited budget, they can sort of attack that problem, the sort of intersection between transit and nutritional needs?
That's a really good question. And as Dana was saying, the perishable foods are one of the things that we waste the most. They're also one of the things that require the most preparation, and they're the heaviest and bulkiest because they haven't been put down into their processed form yet. So, for example, if you want to make a soup, maybe you don't want to lug stock on the on the bus. It's pretty easy to make a soup out of a few ends of onions and carrots, and maybe if you have some chicken bones from another meal, you can make a stock pretty easily, and then you can have a soup based on that. But it is always, I think, in low-income communities, the access to fresh produce is one of the biggest issues, and education around how to use it is another issue as well. And cooking classes that's been a new thing a lot, and I know in a lot of the communities that are working with food in food deserts is, here's the produce, but here's also how you use it. So that's another sticking point, I think.
Sue Sigler, I'm wondering, you know, this gets at another issue, donations to food banks. You know, a lot of companies will say, hey, here's all the Halloween candy on November 2nd, right, that we weren't able to sell. Are food banks getting pickier? Are they in a position to get pickier about what kind of food is being donated to them?
You know, this is a hot topic in food banking right now, and there isn't consensus. There are a couple of different points of view. There are those that would say, gosh, we really don't want to be handling snack foods, candy, sugar-sweetened beverages. We don't consider that essential for health. And there are others who say, you know, there's a kid who doesn't get a birthday cake unless, you know, we provide leftover from a grocery retailer. So, and there there's a thing that says, you know, a lot of people grow up wishing that they had the same thing in their kitchen that other people have. And especially kids notice that. And so...
And everybody wants a treat now and then.
Right. So, again, there isn't a consensus on that in food banks, but there's an awful lot of conversation around it.
Well, let's go now to the phones. We have James in San Francisco.
Yeah, this is a great topic, and I'm glad it's being discussed here. The problem I have is the expiration and use-by dates and the size, okay? Well, can we make them all a quarter inch instead? Some of them are a quarter inch, and then others are a 16th of an inch, where they're being placed on the products, and is this a ploy by producers, manufacturers, distributors, to get people to use more because they're throwing out more because there's no standard size, and I'm wondering if that could be addressed.
Dana Gunders, that sounds like a question for you.
Yeah, and I think by size you're saying kind of the font size. I would love to see a system where our dates are standardized. And my ideal would be to have a little box under the nutrition panel that not only has a standard way of expressing the date, but also gives other safe storage and handling information to help you handle it properly and know how to store it properly and extend the life. And in the UK, they've actually started to move to a system where they have kind of embraced dates as a form of marketing. And so they have bigger fonts, and they give more information and see it as, you know, another way to communicate with their consumers. So I agree. I think it should be made more prominent and more predictably placed and communicated. I don't necessarily think this is a ploy by the industry to get us all to, you know, throw more food away. I think it's more as a benign neglect that has led to this issue, where because there was not federal regulation in the 70s when it was being discussed, the states have had to kind of come up with their own solutions piecemeal. Manufacturers have had to come up with their own systems and as to how to determine these dates. And without any guidelines, it's just kind of a mess.
You're kind of pointing out this strange dichotomy in our food system, that some parts of it are incredibly efficient at getting us food. And indeed, many Americans are suffering from obesity precisely because they have access to certain kinds of food that are ridiculously cheap. And then on the flip side, we have all this, you know, a form of low-grade starvation for people who can't afford or can't have access to, you know, nutritional food.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation around why people are eating processed foods and sort of the coexistence of hunger and obesity, even in the same population, same people, is a whole question and a whole forum conversation unto itself. And it goes back to subsidies and other challenges. But I do believe that the mass efficiency of the food system and in the ways that we are efficient does have this flip side to it that does lead to waste. You know, and for instance, not all food banks can take a truckload of beets, right? They might be able to take a few cases of beets and do something useful with that. But once you show up with a truckload, you need to have a huge cooler to be able to deal with that and big distribution to get it to people.
And I'd like to note that anybody with a truckload of beets, we'd be happy to help you solve that
problem. They can handle it.
They're well equipped here in California. Yes.
And that is something to point out, that, you know, food banks talk to each other, that folks know when there's a need in one particular corner of the state versus another.
Well, one of the reasons that our program works is because our food bank members around the state are so highly cooperative. And Dana provided a really good example that sometimes we receive food in quantity that's too large for any individual food bank to handle in an appropriate period of time or based on their capacity. And so we have an extensive system of sharing excess among the food banks. And oftentimes that truck that might roll full of beets might make three stops. And we work to increase the efficiency of transportation and make sure that it gets to where it'll be utilized most rapidly.
Let's turn now to Cole in San Francisco, who's got a question about milk.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, it's more of a statement. Having been a bachelor for many years, who's actually now not going to be a bachelor for many years, I have been buying milk in cartons, and I found a way to make it so that it doesn't go bad.
And that would be?
Well, I can usually get a carton of milk to last like 2, maybe even 3 weeks after the date, and that would be to remove all the excess air from the carton by folding it down. It looks a little bit ragtag, but it works.
And you're alive to tell us about it today.
Indeed. Works well.
Dana Gunders.
Thanks for the program. It's been really good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I can see you just raring to say something there.
Two things. One would be that, again, this food safety expert we worked with says that he keeps his refrigerator at 34 degrees, so much colder than normal. Most of us are aiming for 40, and that he can get, you know, 6 weeks out of a carton of milk. But the other thing that points out is just the portion sizes. And portion sizes across the country are really leading to a significant amount of waste. And that's true in restaurants. It's also true in our homes, particularly for people who do live alone and want to buy things in smaller quantities and are not always able to do that in the store. So another thing that would be great to see is food businesses providing, you know, portion options that work for people who do live alone.
It does seem like we're seeing more sort of prepackaged vegetables that are coming in little snack sizes, and maybe that wasn't intentionally designed to serve the singleton market, but that's kind of how it's turned out.
Yeah, and I think those packaged vegetables are helpful sometimes, and yet once you've cut them, those products actually don't last as long. You've sort of started a decay process that doesn't happen when they're whole. So depending on how they're used, it could be good or bad.
And some of those salmonella alerts often come out, or listeria alerts come out.
That's right, because it's
attached
another cold,
to those
ready-to-eat food. And then they don't have the option to do the root-to-stock cooking that Tara's been encouraging, because the roots and stalks are all trimmed out at a manufacturing plant.
They don't
somewhere.
Even get to see it. I'm glad you raised the question about restaurants. I mean, we all leave food on restaurant plates. I can't tell you how many times I've ordered an omelet and I forgot to ask for the tomatoes instead of the potatoes, you know, which are drenched in butter. I don't need that for my waistline. So it just sits there and it goes back, you know, when the person comes to bust the table. It seems like restaurants could be doing a lot more to just stop that.
Yeah, and I feel for restaurants. I think potatoes on the breakfast platter have to be the most leftover product. But, you know, I have a friend who used to run a breakfast restaurant, and he experimented with something where he said, hey, customers, we're going to give you less potatoes, and then if you want more, just ask for a refill. And it went fine until the recession hit, and all of a sudden people are getting this plate and it wasn't as full of food as he wanted it, as they wanted it to be. They didn't get the perceived value. And they started going to the restaurant next door. And in such a highly competitive market that restaurants are in, it's really tough because people equate volume with value. And that presents a real challenge for them, particularly when you consider that their food costs are much lower than their rent or their labor. And so it doesn't cost too much more for them to put extra potatoes on if you're going to get another customer for that.
Speaking of clever ideas, let's turn to Deborah in Berkeley. Go ahead, Deborah.
Oh, hi. I thought I was waiting for the next one. My name is Deborah Moore. I'm the executive director of Green Schools Initiative, and I wanted to bring up the topic of food waste at schools, and in particular because we're spending taxpayer dollars to subsidize farmers, and then we subsidize schools to buy surplus commodities, and then students don't eat half of what they take, and it goes to the landfill to create methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, and it just seems like it's such a waste all along the way. So I'd love to hear your comments on food waste in schools.
Wonderful question, Deborah. Dana Fraz, do you want to address that one?
I'd love to. Thank you, Deborah, for the question. So FoodShift has set up a program working with Oakland Unified School District. They came to us about a year ago with the very same concern. Why are we throwing away so much food from the schools when a lot of these kids in Oakland need some additional nutritional support? So we have a program now with two schools in Oakland where we have a refrigerator on site where food that is left over from the end of meals, this is uneaten milks, uneaten fruit, uneaten food from the lunches, we preserve in the refrigerator, and then we have distribution days where parents and the students from that school can come and receive some of that food. And we had an incredible pilot project in May. Over a five-week period, we were able to recover 3,000 pounds of food from one school, and 49 parents from that school came to the distribution. So we're looking to create a model, a toolkit, that can be used throughout schools in the Bay Area and beyond, because there's no reason food should be going to waste at schools.
It's an example of how just one program can have such a substantial impact. It reminds me of all those programs we've heard about in the music industry, in Hollywood, you know, pulling from the catering table what's been left unused or maybe didn't even make it onto the table, might make it onto somebody else's table. Let's turn now to West in San Francisco.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So we have a nonprofit here in the city. It's sort of here in San Francisco, so of course there's an app for that. We are developing an app right now that connects food surpluses to those who need it.
And how does it work?
It's pretty simple. Basically, using everyone likes to say the sharing economy. You have an extra, leftover or something from maybe a catered event. You had a meeting. You've got a bunch of salmon rolls left over. You've got a vegetable. You know you're just not going to use it. You snap a photo. You post it. You wait for someone to call dibs. They grab it. You review each other. And that's about it.
Dana Gunders, are there any legal considerations there? I mean, if I have a, I don't know, a, oh, Sue Sigler, you want to take this question.
I can't speak to transfers from individuals to individuals, but if you're donating a food product to a nonprofit organization, there's something called the Good Samaritan Act that protects you in that regard. So a lot of retailers or manufacturers are very concerned, obvious reasons, about what might happen to that food after it leaves their control. So they wouldn't be able to guarantee at that point that it had been handled properly, stored and refrigerated properly. And so that's the point of that act, is to protect those generous donors from recrimination that might be based on something beyond their control.
Anything you want to add, Dana Gunders?
Yeah, I would say because of food safety considerations, places that have cooked prepared food that's been out for a while have trouble donating that. And so apps like the one that gentleman just talked about that are sort of going around that and letting individuals, if they're willing to, quote, take the risk, go and make use of that food, I think are kind of neat programs. Now, I guess there is a limited food safety risk, and that's why institutions have a harder time being part of that. But it's a great way
but
to use
it. But if
it's
sort
food.
Of friend to friend on a casual basis, all yeah. risks noted up front. We also have John in Berkeley.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
One of the things I do, I try to buy in bulk, and I found in the past that I used to waste a lot of spaghetti sauces or dressings or whatever because I wanted to try to do things different. And so I started putting a Sharpie on, and I write the date of when I opened it so that when I go back into the refrigerator, I don't think, this is too old, I'm going to throw it away. So that was a suggestion. And then one of my questions to your guests are, I often buy chicken, and then I freeze it when I buy it, and then I thaw it out, and I forget about it in the refrigerator. How long after you freeze chicken can you have it thawed in your refrigerator before it's not safe to eat anymore? And I can take my answer off the air.
Thank you so much, John. Tara Duggan, do you want to address that question?
Sure. I mean, I don't know the exact amount of time, because it depends on what it depends on is how much long it was at room temperature before you froze it. But keep in mind how many days it was not room temperature, sorry, refrigerated. Keep in mind how many days it was refrigerated total, including before and after refrigeration, and use the same judgment you would with chicken you buy fresh. So it's usually a few, I don't know, maybe Dana can tell me the official, I would say like 4 to 5 days at the most. And one good thing to do is to freeze the chicken in small portions that you're going to use. Keep it in smaller containers or zip top bags, and then try to plan it into your week if you can. So defrost it overnight in the refrigerator. That's one of the safe ways you can do it. You can also actually defrost it in warm water. The USDA actually did some study about that it's safe. So if you don't have as much time, maybe don't defrost it ahead so you don't have to worry about it. But that also brings up the issue. One thing that I think is really important with food waste is managing your refrigerator, managing your cupboard. So keeping the foods that aren't as perishable, like condiments, maybe on the door of your refrigerator, because they're going to last, and keep all the fresh food organized as much as you can so that you don't have something that you're never going to eat blocking something that's very perishable that you don't see in your refrigerator. And sometimes you do need to throw out a few things so that your refrigerator is more manageable. And also your cupboard, if you have a box of old chicken pilaf mix that you haven't eaten for a year, maybe it's time to get rid of it.
And just acknowledge
that's not happening. So you're going to be able to use the stuff that you really do want to use and make use of it.
You know, organization and labeling seem to be such a big part of not wasting food. I love John's idea of using the Sharpie. Label it. You know, keep yourself apprised of what you have in the fridge. We've gotten a lot of emails, people asking basically if one of the problems is fridges that are too big. You just can't see to the back of them.
Right. And if they are too big, then you're just going to have to find a way to organize, maybe put everything that's more perishable in one area, the less perishable foods in another area, and try to keep rotating things.
And try to maintain control of your family members. Dana Gunders?
Yeah, I think smaller fridges probably would help us waste less. But also, I've had some interesting conversations about, you know, why are refrigerators really have not evolved much since they were created? And could there be a refrigerator of the future that does take waste and organization into mind? And, you know, why does a refrigerator have to be only two temperatures? What if it were five so that we could store foods at temperatures
zones
that were more appropriate? Yeah. What if there were a drawer that had a modified atmosphere just like a spinach bag does that could keep your produce fresh longer, and, you know, a little rotating thing? Who knows? There's all sorts of places you could go with it.
I've also heard about, I guess, that there are RFID tags where it could be that your milk provider could be communicating to you when your milk is going bad. That might be a way that the refrigerator is talking consumers in their homes, in their refrigerators. I want to point out that if you want to learn more about fighting food waste, we've posted some KQED Quest videos on the subject on our website. So simply visit kqed.org/forum to get a hold of those. I want to thank our guests, Dana Gunders, Sue Sigler, Tara Duggan, and Dana Fraz. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.